Hello and welcome to the Green Room at Furnitubes. I'm your host, Catherine Barrett, and we're here every month with a new episode. Join us for industry musings, interviews and discussions exploring all things landscape architecture, street furniture and urban design. Welcome back to Decarbonising Construction, our two-part episode kicking off our sustainability series. In part one, we focused on the state of the industry and how landscape architects can help make a difference. In part two, we'll conclude our discussion around materials and supply chain. We'll discuss how this can affect creativity, and Alistair will answer our quickfire questions. We pick up the conversation where we discuss the use of reclaimed materials on a large scale.
For me, when you look at a project that utilises local, in some ways you feel like you've got much more control, but then capacity is limited. And that's one of those aspects that I think you have to accept. You might be looking at a longer lead time. You might be looking at a business that only has a few people delivering the requirements for the job. But equally, the one thing I didn't say is the risk transfer is over to the contractor. So the contractor had to be comfortable with a concrete that had reduced cement,
right,
that was made from recycled aggregates, that was on top of a recycled subbase. You know, the client wasn't going to take that risk. The design consultants weren't going to take that risk. So the contractor took that risk. And that's the direction of travel, ultimately. And where we are involved in a project, we're involved in buildability early.
Yeah.
So be it for a PCSA or early contractor involvement, I think you get greater outcomes.
Yeah.
But as I kind of talked about procurement needs to change, because if you don't have that mechanism, you are receiving something cold in an open environment. It's for the first time and you're given 4 weeks to turn that tender around. Yeah. So procurement is key. And as I've said a lot, time. If you've got time to procure, if you've got time to plan, if you've got time to build, a project becomes more environmentally conscious, more socially conscious. And actually, I think you get greater, more positive outcomes for a project.
Everybody.
But of course, that's an ideal world and we're not there yet.
It's interesting, isn't it, that time can't be factored in. It does, you know, if you allow X more weeks or months, it doesn't cost the client anymore. I don't know if it means there are more people on site for longer, so there is a cost with that time, or it's just the planning time, so allowing suppliers longer to deliver.
So my perception, and don't necessarily want to be held to this, is that I see advantages of, say, 4 weeks longer to plan may well result in 2 weeks less time on site. So there shouldn't be a cost to a client, because the pre-mobilisation costs or an agreement with a contractor in PCSA should ultimately, resources-wise, be less depending on how complex it is. So more time we've got ahead means we can look at construction and find the most efficient way of delivering the scheme. That could be, don't excavate any subbase. So you could take 4 weeks out of a project and all of that waste removed from a site by a simple activity to perhaps do some exploratory trial holes, in situ CBR testing before you've even broken ground. And that to me would start to drive some of these improvements to projects.
Everybody wins.
Yeah. And ultimately, selfishly as a contractor, our biggest risk is when we break ground and we start excavating things. So to remove risk from a project also results in a better outcome for everybody. Yeah. You know, the contractor can look at something and say, well, there's less risk associated with this project, so even our fixed price allowances may well reduce if we're in a JCT contract. Equally, a client perhaps doesn't have to have a significant contingency or can spend more money on environmentally conscious outcomes or things that people see and interact with. So I don't think anyone really wins from everything that sits below ground, because it's not visible. You can't interact with it.
Yeah.
And ultimately, the longer you're in there, it's costing time and ultimately money.
And that's the biggest source of waste emissions.
Yes, exactly.
Well.
Exactly.
So it's sort of issue on top of issue. So what do you see suppliers like Furnitubes? How can we contribute? How can the supply chain help the landscape construction industry?
We've talked about this previously, but if you take the comments I made at the start regarding proportionately where waste sits within the construction industry, and I suppose emotively, everyone looks at a product coming in and it being packaged and it being packaged with single-use plastics. I think the industry has gone leaps and bounds, and some manufacturers are starting to use products that are recoverable and recyclable. So we're seeing more cardboard. We're seeing coir being utilised to protect edges.
Yep.
We're seeing timber being used. We're seeing
less edges as well.
Yeah, yep. So we're seeing less products that would be considered single use coming to site.
Right.
Get it more efficient, but equally, it comes back to risk. So Malham as a contractor accept no risk for the period of time that that product leaves Furnitubes and arrives on site. Furnitubes take no risk in that timescale of it leaving, and it sits there with a haulier. So a haulier doesn't necessarily accept that risk. So hence, the ultimate is you package it up.
Like crazy, and cotton wool. And
to ensure that it gets to a project intact. And then we install the product, and then we wrap it up to protect it during the final construction process so that we can hand that product over to the client, you know, damage-free. Yeah. So there's an element of you can't remove the activity of protecting something either during transport or once it's installed. You just have to find a way of using products that can either be reused or can be recovered and recycled. So nothing to do with furniture, but if you look at plants coming from a nursery, cheap is to load them all into a timber pallet, and often they're wrapped in a single-use plastic, and you can recover the timber, just about recover, recycle the pots. Single-use plastic ends up going to landfill. If you work with a supplier and you're prepared to pay more, and importantly, that paying more is reflected in your price to the client, so in effect, the client is paying more, you can get them on a Dutch trolley. And that Dutch trolley can be wrapped in a coat, and that coat can be reused. So we're seeing a trolley that is taken back to the nursery and used on the next journey, and a coat that's removing the single-use plastic. But you've got more space requirement on a load than things being packed in densely into a single crate. Then you'd need to weigh up the options of, is that then two more loads or three more loads?
Right.
And what's the carbon associated with it?
Yep.
But, you know, those decisions to, I guess, try and remove as much waste in that process as possible, of course, they need time to assess and run the numbers, so to speak, because it's going to be different for every project. If you've got projects in London, projects in Bristol, Glasgow, Birmingham, and you're using the same nursery, of course, the metrics and the outcomes are going to be very different for each project. You're going to have more miles between source and site. So those decisions have to be weighed up against what it's going to cost and I suppose the carbon generated from it.
But rules and calculations can be made when you know the inputs. You can work out the various inputs.
You can. But what can, I think, manufacturers do? I think you're going down that route of having components that are the same, regardless of what the bench looks like at the end. Some of those components are exactly the same. It's modelled on the same processes so that your manufacturing can be more efficient. The waste arising from manufacturing can be less, and you're generating more of them.
Yes.
So that there's a degree of efficiency in the cost. So I think manufacturers are tasked with just making their processes more efficient so that waste is minimised. I don't think you're ever going to get over the conundrum of packing something up to protect it. But the materials utilised to do that can, of course, be altered.
Can they be reused again and again and again? So there are ways of bringing things to site where that delivery package can be taken back to a warehouse. Or a
similar to the Dutch trolleys in the nursery.
Exactly the same,
You can protect something in transport, and if that product can be then sent back and reused, then of course you remove any waste arising from that activity of delivering something to site, which of course that happens on every site.
Yes. So ideally we see less wastage sitting. I remember when I was talking to you about this a few months ago, you know, the vision of it's the packaging, that all of the...
Everybody
the
sees
products.
The packaging everybody can quite quickly, you know, see. So I think I saw a comment about some cladding that was, of course, had a single-use plastic film over
the top, yeah.
But I don't think you're ever going to remove that.
Right.
Because, of course, the contractor needs
to protect that
to yeah. protect it during installation.
Yeah.
You're not necessarily going to have a sheet that can be removed or stuck on or
rice
fixed
paper.
On. Well, you know, it's kind of... anything that's perishable in that environment just doesn't work. Yet, if it hasn't got the film, you've then got the risk of damages. And is the client going to accept damage? No, they're not.
No.
So
no.
You as contractor carrying that risk are protecting that product. Does the process change? I don't get something sent to site with a powder coated or finish and you're actually resorting to painting something again. There are ways and means of doing it, but equally it requires compromise during the design process if you want to eliminate a certain product from use.
But it's weighing up the benefits.
Yeah, weighing up the benefits. And I'll go back to it. At the moment, it costs more. That's the reality. It costs more to do it.
Yeah. Do you think some of the requirements, not the requirements, but some of the things that we've been talking about in an effort to minimise carbon emissions could have an impact on creativity and some of the approaches or some of the freedom that we see going towards putting a great emphasis on wonderful public spaces and greening the urban environment, which is such a great to have that focus and it's the right thing. We're seeing lots of creative schemes and on a really large scale. Is there a danger that by focusing more on one aspect, so on carbon emissions, we might lose some of the creativity or the freedom that landscape architect might have in terms of approaching schemes?
I think there is a risk, yes, of impacting creativity, but actually there's a huge opportunity to be very creative with how we see a site and how we might repurpose it. So it's twofold, really. Of course, anything that's bespoke has more waste, be it precast concrete, it's forming, it's moulds, they're all be bespokely made for that situation.
And never used again.
Yeah. So if you look at some very nice diving platforms in the London Aquatic Centre, you know, the formwork involved in creating those, that will never be used again.
Right.
So there is this aspect for me that I would never want to see the design process constrained by this need to reduce waste.
Yep.
But you could then look at different materials. So if you were looking at terrazzo, it's a very diverse product.
Yep.
So you can use a recycled aggregate in it. You can form it. It's more malleable and it can be utilized in very different ways to perhaps taking a big block of granite and trying to cut a curvilinear bench from it and seeing all of that waste material going into either an aggregate or worse still, just repurposed in a type one fill. So I feel that perhaps we need to be more creative in how we reuse things and importantly, how we look to reduce waste by the decisions we make in terms of materiality. It might make public realm even more diverse because we're looking at the characteristics of materials in a finer grain to then bring them into our projects so that we're replacing, I suppose, more wasteful activities with less wasteful activities, but actually the outcome could be incredibly creative.
That absolutely makes sense. How is Malim approaching some of the topics that we've been talking about and what are the plans over the next couple of years? Do you have specific strategies or goals or tactics to look at some of the issues we've been talking about today?
Again, split it into two. So scope one, scope two emissions are in our control and we are on a very positive journey to minimise those emissions and get to, you know, position of net zero from those activities very quickly. From now, effectively, all our fleet is carbon-free fuels.
Yep.
We are investing in more efficient plant and equipment. And as the technology develops with electric plant, we will invest in that route. So that's ultimately the lesser, though, of our activities. We then kind of go to supply chain. And it's working with conscious supply chain partners that have net zero well on their agenda and are advancing very quickly towards achieving that. We've invested heavily in, I suppose, platforms so that we can understand our performance, you know, our waste generation, our water usage on our sites, our fuel usage, trying to be as efficient as possible.
Right.
So where we using 100 litres of fuel, can we do that operation using 80 litres of fuel?
Right.
That fuel might have been diesel 2 years ago. Can it be an alternative fuel?
Yep.
Can it be a greener fuel? But again, a greener fuel costs more. So if we're pricing that in, are we pricing on a level playing field?
Right.
Are all contractors pricing that work for the client, pricing on the basis of using a green fuel? Mm. If they are, your competition is ultimately pricing it in the same way. So you're not going to be at a
disadvantage
from making that kind of conscious decision to use something that's greener. I guess where would we like to? We'd love to be involved in projects from the outset. And by outset, I mean early in kind of REBA stages two, three, whereby we're brought in under a PCSA or early contractor involvement to really get into the detail, get under the skin of the job and get the efficiencies out of the job. Because as a business, we contribute very little in our scope one, scope two. It's not the area where we need to have the greatest level of focus because I feel it's a very quick win and we can get to a position of being more sustainable very quickly.
If you have input further, earlier.
Yeah.
So rather than being brought in just to deliver without having any input at the beginning, you can have much more impact being brought in earlier.
Yeah. And the project benefits ultimately. And that's where our biggest proportion of carbon associated with our activities is located ultimately. You know, we can control how much carbon we utilise in putting our fleet out in London or operating our temporary setups on site using solar powered eco units, using alternative fuels, but slightly less in control of what happens in a project in terms of its specification, where the supply chain is located, what supply chain partners in London we can utilise.
Yeah.
Because being a London focused business, we look at our colleagues, they are travelling locally, they're making conscious, because of being in London, those decisions to travel by public transport. We've got, you know, a significant number of our colleagues utilising public transport to get to our sites. So they're huge numbers or huge amounts of positive activities within the Mailand business, and this ambition to consistently strive. So from January, all of our sites will be utilising smart waste to record and monitor and ultimately assess and evaluate our performance during the next year, so that we can consistently stretch ourselves to improve on minimising waste. You know, at the minute we set ourselves a target 5 years ago to be 94% of our waste generated going to positive, either recycle, repurpose routes. We're at 98%.
Wow.
So, you know, I'd say performing, but equally we want to be doing more.
Just going back to being involved at earlier stages, I know you're making sure that Mailim can be involved at earlier stages. So working in more of the planning stages, working with landscape architects and having more of an impact. Is that something that Mailim had done previously, or is it more of a focus going forward?
Again, it's split between commercial and public sector. Yeah. So in commercial environments, there is this almost this drive and expectation that you are involved early on, depending on the relationship ultimately, because sometimes that can be in advance of a procurement process.
Yep.
So, you know, you'd almost take the defensive approach of protecting all your good ideas for later. But then sometimes decisions have been made through planning that could prevent those good ideas from kind of carrying through. There might be a driver in that environment once tier ones have been let that contract to work for a PCSA to drive efficiencies in the project. Your ultimate aim is historically been reducing costs, but actually it probably should be flipped to the other side to reduce environmental impact. And that actually might cost more. In a public world, I have taken this kind of aspiration to share knowledge. And the only way you can share knowledge is to collaborate and be involved in these organisations that ultimately are looking for knowledge and information to better their scheme. So be it, you know, Mailim doing a CPD series, which we're commencing next year, whereby we're quite happy to go into a landscape practice and talk about time, talk about planning, talk about mobilisation stages and having more time in pre-construction to really understand the job. You know, some projects have been on a drawing board for a year, 2 years,
Why
we get 4 weeks.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we get 4 weeks to tender a project.
Yeah.
And we often then get 2 or 4 weeks to mobilize a contract, and we get 16 weeks to build it.
Yeah.
And it's a bit of a whirlwind, and almost the wrong decisions are being made along that process to limit the positivity that can come out of it. And, you know, very, very simply speaking, not necessarily environmental or related to climate, but if you look at social value, if you look at local employment, you've got 4 weeks to recruit local people.
Right.
You've got to find them. You've got to interview them. You've got to
train them.
Yep. And your project's finished. And if you were looking at apprenticeships, if it's a 16-week project, an apprenticeship's 18 months. So in effect, you're pricing that apprentice into your offer, because ultimately they're going to be retained by the business beyond the life of the contract. Right. But if no one else is doing that, you're immediately at £30,000 deficit against the competition. So it goes back to procurement and time ultimately. More time you've got, the better the outcome.
We see lots of schemes where you've got the balance of wanting to have a very creative and original visual, certainly from a furniture perspective, which we love. And we're seeing some really fantastic outdoor schemes at the moment. Where we've tried to develop is with modular schemes, with modular furniture, we minimize waste, we become much more efficient in manufacture, in the materials that we procure to produce standard modules, but providing the landscape architect and the contractors the ability to create unique and completely different and creative schemes each time, but not starting from scratch with a single use bespoke scheme or item with something that won't be used again, or elements or materials that won't be used again. So for us, modularity is about cost, but also the environmental impact. And because we can be super, super efficient with products that we make day in, day out, we just want to make sure that they're put together in a really cool, creative way for landscape architects.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because, I mean, even when you take a simple thing, I see modular being much more efficient in buildability.
Right.
Because ultimately it reduces waste. Now, that doesn't necessarily play out in how things are put together, because often we see a drawing that's based on critical dimensions. So,
right.
So if you've got a meter opening and that's being paved out in 600 mil by 600 mil modular units, you're going to end up with, you know, 200 mil being taken off of one, and that actually becomes waste. So we love schemes whereby there's been some thought about bonds, about cuts, because of course, if you're not cutting something, you haven't got these unsightly slivers everywhere. And I think the most successful schemes have been the ones that really considered the detailing, because you get certainly a better outcome visually, but then you generate less waste. And importantly, you know, waste, not only is it bad for the environment, it also costs money.
Yes.
So if you're pricing something on a 10% wastage, that's going to cost the client at the end. And you've got all of the associated hazards. So from a health and safety perspective, the moment you start cutting anything on site, you're exposing our colleagues to silica dust. So you've got the PPE requirements, you've got the extraction requirements, the cutting station. So if you take those elements away, you've got improved health and safety, you're taking away risk and hazard, and ultimately you're reducing the cost. So modular doesn't have to impact creativity. It can actually produce something that's much more refined and much more thought in terms of its process.
And the supplier has usually thought through the best use cases for those modular products as well.
Absolutely.
We often ask a couple of questions to all our guests at the end of each podcast. So the first one is, what drew you to landscape architecture as a career, first of all? And actually for you, you've moved from practicing as a landscape architect, where you're still a chartered landscape architect, into the landscape construction industry. And what was the rationale or the reasoning for that move?
Very long plotted history, cut very, very short. Family history in commercial horticulture. So great-great-grandfather grew plums on the North Kent coast, and the entity disappeared because we, as a population, wanted cheap plums from South Africa. So we've seen that kind of circular activity of commercial horticulture dying in the UK because of competition elsewhere.
Yeah.
But I had this kind of interest in art and design, and I remember looking at It's Fenella Bellinger, chartered landscape architect. She was doing her degree. My mum was friends with her mum. She had some drawings out on the table. I was just fascinated by it. I went to my careers advisor because it was work experience time at school. And I said, I want to be a landscape architect. And he looked at me and with these eyes and just said, this is too difficult. Why can't you go? Why can't you go down any of these routes? So I cold called Liz Lake Associates, a practice local to home.
Yeah.
So at 14, I did 2 weeks there. And then I did every summer afterwards.
Wow.
Because I was just captivated by this discipline of not necessarily being a specialist in one foot. You had to have a legal understanding. You had to understand finance, commercial. You had to be great at designing things. It covered the horticultural interests that are, you know, ingrained in my DNA. So there is this element of it ticked a huge number of boxes as a career. The path has been very, perhaps not considered at the start. So I went into practice, I gained my chartership. Then the Olympics came along. I had a fantastic opportunity to go and work on the Olympics on the client side. So I joined Lee Valley Regional Park Authority, was involved in a lot of Olympic fringe work and the North Park, and then got this bizarre phone call in 2011, when at the time the Landscape Group had been awarded the Estates and Facilities Management contract for the park. And I saw that as an opportunity to see a project through design, build, and its legacy management, which is where a vast number of decisions are made about how a design evolves. And, you know, we are influenced in our world by a big yellow dot in the sky.
Yeah.
And a lot of decisions are made, a decision to cut or not cut, how you maintain something ultimately impacts or drives where it ends up in 5, 10, 15, 20 years. So that was the sell back then. Also tasked with re-establishing construction. So there were lots of benefits in terms of moving across. And where I'd say my strengths are, it's in the detail. As a landscape architect practicing, it was all in kind of technical drawings and receiving something. You know, I wouldn't say I'm the best conceptualist. I'm a realist. You know, I build things. I know what it takes to construct and maintain. So every line a landscape architect puts on a drawing, it has an impact to the person building it, the person maintaining it, the person deconstructing it. And that's where my interests lie. But if I wind the clock back to 2004, we were doing lots of clerk of works requirements out there on site all of the time. And then clients were... I suppose procuring less with you,
right?
Transferring it over to the contractor, and I just saw it as a huge opportunity to, you know, ultimately we talk about it. We need more skills, different skills in businesses. You would go through exactly the same process to better and continually develop and offer something very different to either your competitors or adding great value to your client base. So
having an understanding of all the disciplines,
you know, as a chartered landscape architect, I often, you know, when I introduce myself and say, who do you work for, and now, you know, even over the last 3 months, Maylim, what do Maylim do? We're an external works contractor. Why would you work for a contractor? Why wouldn't I work for a contractor? You know, and it's as a business, we're now a registered practice of the Landscape Institute. Again, lots of people saying, why would you do that? Why it isn't to become a landscape architecture practice providing commercial professional services to clients. It's to access knowledge. It's to share knowledge. It's to work with practices much earlier in ensuring that we get landscapes that are developed and delivered more sustainably, and I'd like to say more practically and efficiently. And that can only come through collaborating. And we often always talk about, what could we do differently? And I've been to numerous conferences where I've heard the same messages over the last 20 years, and it might just take a contractor, two contractors, four contractors to just do something different, and we might see some positive change.
Thank you. Last question. If you could put a bench in one spot in the world, where would it be and why?
So it was the toughest question, I think, you'd fielded at the start. And I said, can I have two? But kind of reflecting on it, I grew up in Much Haddam. And Much Haddam, or Peregrine, is Henry Moore country. And I would cite it because it covers a number of interests. On a hill within the foundation that looks over one of his sculptures, surrounded by sheep, because I've got, you know, farming background as well, in somewhere in the family. And it's in a landscape that I grew up with and love. So had the great privilege of bounding around in the foundation over all of his work. And there's kind of this influence that I think he's had on a career and that kind of progression into landscape architecture.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Alistair.
Absolutely. I really enjoyed it. So look forward to hearing it.
It's been a good chat.
Yeah, it has.
Thank you.